The following content is sponsored by Atlantis Sports Clubs and does not reflect the views of WATD Radio. It's Friends with Benefits on 95.9 WATD, exploring relationships, social issues, sports, and life stories. Be a part of the show at 781-837-4900. This is Brian Stratton's Friends with Benefits with your hosts, Paul Kearney, Gabe Sirota, Joe Coletti, and Bob Anderson.
Okay, welcome to our show tonight. You're listening to WATD 95.9 FM, Friends with Benefits. We have Blue Saris Consulting Manager Partner, Michelle Hager, on the phone with us. How are you, Michelle?
I'm doing great, Joe. It's great to be back on the show tonight.
We have a local doctor on the phone, Dr. Torquem Garabedian. Dr. Garabedian is the medical director of the Outpatient Primary Care Clinic of Lawrence General Hospital. He is skilled in clinical research with background in cardiovascular research, public speaking. Background includes a doctorate of medicine from the American University of Beirut and internal medicine residency from St. Elizabeth's Medical Center right here in Boston. Primary areas of interest are cardiovascular health, preventive health, and effective delivery of healthcare. Hello, Dr. Garabedian. Thanks for joining the show with us tonight.
Hi, thank you, John, Michelle. It's a pleasure to be with you tonight.
Yeah, we have been thanking doctors and nurses and first responders on this show every week and appreciate your dedication to keeping us safe during this very difficult time. I see you received your MD at American University of Beirut. Do you have family there?
As a matter of fact, I do. Thank you for asking. I have three sisters and one brother. Thankfully, they are safe, obviously shaken by the situation, but they are safe. And, you know, we are closely monitoring what's happening there.
Dr. Garabedian, as a primary care physician, you're typically the first stop in the line of treatment. What is it like working at Lawrence General Hospital? How are you staying safe?
Well, it is a rewarding, very rewarding, and at the same time challenging experience in good ways. It's rewarding in that it is relatively underserved as a population, and it is hardly hit by the current situation of COVID-19. So it's a very rewarding situation in that sense, because you're truly impacting people who need the care, who need the help, and you see the benefits of, you reap the fruits of the healthcare that you delivered. It's challenging because obviously it's been badly hit by the pandemic, and you know, you do typically have a low socioeconomic status in that area. So a lot of what you do is more effort, more education, more discussion about prevention than in other areas of the country. Now, as to the second part of your question about how to be safe, thankfully we've had a pretty rigid and I would say solid infectious control protocols in place, which allow, you know, a more bigger role for telemedicine and allow those who really need to come in and are sick, need to be seen, to still be seen in a safe way.
We know that Lawrence General in that area, as you said, is a underserved area. And based on some of the work that we've done previously in that area, understand that it's a high multicultural, high Hispanic population. Do you think that given the cultural effects of the Hispanic folks that they've had a more hard hit on the pandemic, or is that related to access to care or a combination?
I think it's a combination of things. In a culture where people often get together in with big families or large families, many gatherings probably facilitate transmission of virus. And then also the lack in probably awareness while, you know, in a place of higher socioeconomic status, people would be more aware quicker. You have to do more education and more outreach before you get the message to the population so that everybody is on the same level and receives the same level of care.
Yeah, absolutely. And are you seeing Lawrence General and the surrounding clinical service providers, are they doing different things to communicate to the population of where they can get care, how to avoid contagion, and how to avoid spread?
Well, I think first things first, I think at the state level, a lot has been done and strong work has already been done. And as a second line, I think Lawrence as a city has done a great job in raising awareness. And Lawrence General, as you probably know, has set up a site of testing for COVID-19 that delivers, you know, almost daily testing. And so to all Lawrence residents, even those who are just curious and want to have it tested. So this has been a great outreach. So I don't know anybody who's unaware of that site in Lawrence, for example. Everybody knows where they need to get tested if they need to be tested. And from what I've seen from patient care, direct patient care, is that everybody is now well-versed and understands how COVID spreads. So I do think that both at the state level, but also more locally at the hospital level and the city level, a lot has been done and continues to be done.
Yeah, that is. It's good to hear that you're being careful and coordinating visits with your patients and following strict safety guidelines. Has this put delays in scheduling visits due to the pandemic?
To be fair and honest about this, most preventive care has been on the back burner. It has been delayed in so many ways. And my concern remains, as a primary care physician, the timely delivery of care to those who struggle from or suffer from chronic conditions like diabetes, hypertension, coronary artery disease, heart failure, those people who actually need to be seen. And also delays in preventive care, in routine preventive care, meaning the mammograms, the colonoscopies. You know, you might have a patient who needed a colonoscopy in the beginning of 2020 because they had a polyp 3 years ago that needed follow-up, and, you know, that might be delayed. So these are things that we cannot control. But the good thing is that we have come up with a system that allows a rigid screening on the phone, basically in compliance with the AMA, American Medical Association, and also Massachusetts state guidelines. We have a list of questions we ask patients, and those patients who screen negative on the questions are offered in office, face-to-face with provider appointments, even for routine visits, or patients who are high risk and just need to be seen at 1 month or 3 month interval, they could still come in based on negative screening. And the second level to that we have established is that if somebody tests positive but still needs to come in, we have designated area in the clinic where only the provider would go with the patient, and still a visit could be done with full protective equipment so that delivery of care is still timely. And obviously the rest, which is close to 50%, is televisits, whether video or telephone.
That's interesting. It's good that you've done so much to be able to keep everybody safe. And have you been working to increase your telehealth services because of the need to keep distance and prevent the spread? How much have you been relying on telehealth?
I would say we are close to 40 to 50% of visits are now telehealth. In the beginning, in the first worst months, we were close to, in the beginning at some point, almost 100% of telehealth. But as you know, the numbers have gone down and as people are more aware, we have been able to implement the screening on the phone strategy and allow more in-person visits. Now, out of telehealth, we use an app called Doximity, which is very widespread for clinicians. And I think that allows easy video visits, which is close to an office visit almost, short of an exam. Mm-hmm. So this, you know, typically the people who can benefit from this are people who are usually younger or have some, basic understanding of a smartphone use. So you cannot reach everybody equally, but these are the limits of the current situation. The rest are reached by phone, which is not ideal. I do want to see more in-office visits safely and as time allows and as numbers decrease.
I know Lawrence General Hospital is near the New Hampshire and Maine borders. Are you considering treating patients outside of Mass to meet the growing need? What would you perceive to be some of the challenges in doing this?
So I do know that a lot of restrictions were lifted from licenses and liability in terms of liability because of the situation. So yes, absolutely, we are open to that idea. Now, at the same time, I don't know if, the growing needs and the growing questions are also more because of the virus. So the volume has been not low, actually higher than before. You know, patient calls, volume of patients and P patients who want to be seen or have discussions have been higher. So I don't know how much we can physically accommodate, but if and when the need arises, obviously, you know, we are very open to stating crossing state lines to deliver care.
So for our listeners out there, Doctor, tell folks how a telehealth visit would work and how successful it is from your perspective to be able to provide good quality care, particularly in those chronic disease management areas that you mentioned. Tell our listeners how you've perceived telehealth to work from a clinical perspective and what they can expect if they haven't done a visit yet.
Well, very interesting question, actually, because it, whether you like it or not, at some point or another, you might need a televisit, even if you're young and healthy, given how things have gone. So you can still do a lot by telemedicine, specifically if the physician knows the patient already, and or if the issue is a simple issue that needs a discussion. The good news is that for problems that are visual, you know, whether it's a skin issue or something that the provider can look at and see, even sometimes for neurological complaints, although it's limited, but you can still see a lot on a with a video. A lot can be done through televisits. Now, to come to the second part, which is the chronic medical condition patients, I will come back to the same point. If your physician knows you well, and that is the key to primary care, really, you can safely do televisits even more than once. I've had patients that I haven't seen for, whom I haven't seen for about 6 months now, and I know they're okay, because between myself, nursing visits, and being close to their family, anytime I talk to them, it's just continuing from where we left off last time. And they would only be asked to come in if there is a clear change in clinical situation, where they just tell you that I'm more short of breath, or where they tell you I have a focal complaint that needs to be examined. But short of that, everything else can be done through telemedicine, and specifically with the luxury of video evaluation.
Yeah, that's definitely a step up, right? You're able to actually see people, to your point, in skin. And I think it's important for our listeners to know that doctors like yourself, nurses that are working with folks every day in primary care, that you're thinking about those patients. You remember them, you want to see them, you don't want them to get lost in the ether and the system. You want to know that they're okay. And so not coming to a visit is a real heart-wrenching aspect or a heart-wrenching feeling for you as a caregiver. So do a telehealth visit. If you've been afraid to do it, don't be afraid. Do a telehealth visit, at least to check in with your physician so you can get that feedback, and your clinicians that you normally see are able to feel comforted to know that you're either the same or that they've helped you with whatever it is that might be going on. I'm sure that this is something that you consider as you've not been able to see your patients under normal circumstances.
Yes, and if I may add a point to that, the good news about telemedicine is that because of the discussion, the clinician can also determine if this is okay to keep as a televisit or if the person really needs to come in. So you can screen those patients on the phone, and there's always a second step to the conversation if you think that this is not something that would be best served just by a televisit. So don't ever be, my encouragement to those who need care would be that don't ever delay calling the physician or being involved in a televisit because it's not ideal or because you would prefer to hold your question until you see the provider, because there's a lot you can still do, even blood pressure, for example, which is such a chronic issue, right? Yes, you always like to have a blood pressure done in the office. It's always more accurate because you have the better equipment. But at the same time, there's chronic hypertension management that you can do from confines of home. And they just log their blood pressure and they call you, and that could be just a televisit. But if you're diabetic and you're pretty good at recording your numbers, keeping a logbook, and pretty good at knowing the doses of your medications, or if you're not so good with that, you can have a family member helping you with that. All these things can be done safely with a televisit.
Very interesting. You know, Michelle and I have been promoting telehealth for more than 10 years. doing telehealth conferences all over the country. Michelle has been a keynote speaker at a lot of these telehealth conferences and resource centers and HIMSS. And we've seen some real movement in the regulations for allowing the use of telehealth since the start of this pandemic. Now you're seeing these waiver laws come in, and they're really affecting and bringing telehealth forward quickly. How is that affecting you? And would you still want to see more done on the state and federal level for these telehealth waiver laws?
I haven't seen any restrictions from personal practice or, you know, practice-wide, I would say. I'm pretty happy with how all insurances have really done what they're supposed to do so far. I'm sure more can be done, but to be fair and honest, I haven't seen that whether compensation to the clinic would be declined or any other restrictions that I may think of. The only thing I would say that clinicians have to be accurate in time reporting, because there are certain requirements to televisits for them to qualify as a formal visit, because I think the danger is that because it's less regulated and the patient is not there, it could be misused by clinicians who might not do the extra effort to really go through medication list, allergies, medical history taking, because you don't have a medical assistant who does this on televisit level. You're doing this. And technically, you don't want to assume things are fine and assume that they're on the same medications, assume everything is the same, specifically because you're not seeing them. You're just talking to them oftentimes. So I would say I haven't seen any restrictions, but I also see room for improvement and from clinicians to make sure the televisits are used in the best possible way.
Those video visits are a good way, to your point earlier, to make sure that you're having a more thorough visit, because you can often have a conversation with someone. And I have a pharmacy background, so how many times I've heard, well, I take the pink pill for my heart and I take the white pill for, you know, my skin or whatever the situation is. And they may not know what the drugs are. So actually seeing them on the screen, being able to verify that, yes, that is a hypertension drug or that is a drug for your dermatology needs. That's such a key area for sure.
It's a good point. Exactly. Absolutely.
Dr. Garabedian, I have one more question for you. And regarding zip codes and how they can often point to the level of access to care that patients have. How do you see telehealth bridging that gap and using measurable data to show success?
Great question. Actually, we are located right in Lawrence. So although the population is underserved compared to other areas, you know, we are very reachable for the population. So that's a good thing that, you know, even the zip code of Lawrence would not be underserved in terms of reaching us. How do I see telehealth bridging? I think the role of telehealth has grown a lot, as you said. And I think the greatest advantage is specifically those patients who are the ones who would not show to appointments or who would not make an effort, who would just forget, who have mild dementia, who would not be reachable otherwise, whom you can get on the phone. I cannot tell you how many times somebody would no show to an appointment and I would still make an effort to call them and would still be able to see them as on a video consult or a teleconsult because of the telehealth luxury. And I think this is a huge change because now you're extending care and you're reaching more people than you were ever able to. Some patients would tell you, for example, that I don't have anybody to bring me. So that would be a no show. Somebody who just didn't come for the diabetes care, they just didn't come. But then when you talk to them, you find out that the taxi didn't come or they didn't have a form that would allow them to come. And now you're reaching this patient at their home. And there have been proposals about sending at the ACO level specifically, sending oximeters to their homes or temperature devices to their homes for patients who cannot come in or don't want to come in and have signs or symptoms of COVID-19. So there are ways where you can set up a televisit to screen those needs and still reach those patients where they are as opposed to bringing them in if they cannot come in.
It's an excellent point. And the technology is advancing every day to be able to do more and more in the home. And I think that we'll see innovation in telehealth explode even more now that we've seen just a high momentum. As you said, you've got up to 50% of your practice actually covering through telehealth. So as we see more usage, we'll see more innovation in this market, and we'll see vendors meeting that need, which will mean that patients will get even more convenience and better care through telehealth. And I thought you made a really good point that some of these patients aren't coming just because they can't get there. The taxi didn't get there. So telehealth is often the difference between care and no care. It's an important point. Thank you so much for being here, Dr. Garabedian.
Well, it was a pleasure to be with you on the show tonight.
Yes, we're talking to Dr. Torkum Garabedian from Lawrence General Hospital. Thank you for your time tonight, Dr. Garabedian. Our show's goal is to bring our listeners, educated and established doctors, nurses, and healthcare workers in to speak with us. We want to provide our listeners the latest information in healthcare, not only locally, but on a national level. So thank you very much, Dr. Garabedian. It was great talking to you, and we will follow up. We'll be right back. You're listening to WATD 95.9 FM, Friends with Benefits.
Experience the Atlantis Sports Club difference. Atlantis Sports Club and Spas are located throughout Massachusetts, including locations in Dedham, Danvers, and Hyannis. Featuring state-of-the-art cardiovascular and strength training equipment, plus indoor and outdoor pools and full-service spas, Atlantis offers something for everyone. How about Zumba, spinning, and strength training classes, swim lessons for the kids, or a luxurious spa treatment? Your Atlantis membership allows access to all locations.
Atlantis in Dedham is located at 25 Allied Drive at the Hilton Hotel in Dedham. When you're on the North Shore, check out the Danvers location located at Ferncroft, next to the Coco Key Water Park at the Hilton.
Take a mini vacation at Atlantis Sports Club and Spa in Hyannis. Play golf, then relax by the resort-style pool. Mention this ad and receive 20% off any spa treatment. Experience the Atlantis difference today. Visit AtlantisSportsClubs.com and book your tour today.
Okay, welcome back this week to Friends with Benefit, WATD 95.9 FM. We have a great show planned for you tonight. We will be speaking with the VP of Customer Success with BrightMD, Julia Millard. BrightMD is based in Portland, Oregon, and was founded by physicians and technology experts with decades of real-world experience. They understand the complexities and pain points of modern healthcare delivery. Julia brings more than a decade of experience successfully introducing new technologies to the healthcare industry, including 6 years of healthcare IT implementation at Epic and more than 7 years in healthcare IT consulting and operational experience at one of the country's largest health systems. Julia has led or supported a number of implementations at major health systems nationally. She ensures customers achieve maximum value with BrightMD products, working towards successful outcomes with product adoption, marketing, clinical quality, and more. Also on the phone with us tonight is Blue Cirrus Consulting Managing Partner and our show sponsor, Michelle Hager. Hello, Michelle.
Hi, Joe. Thanks so much for having us on the show tonight. I'm super excited about the show. Julia is going to be a great guest, and I know BrightMD has done some great work across the country, so we'll be interested to hear about all the things that she has to tell us about. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Joe. Hi, Michelle. Thank you for the great introduction and inviting me on your radio show. And Michelle, it's so great to connect with you again after our panel at ATA earlier this year.
It was such a great panel. We did a panel on sort of how telehealth is, how do you use telehealth in the industry and the challenges that customers have and client, you know, hospitals have. And we had a great panel. It was you and me, and now I'm going to forget the other guy. Advanced ICU also was on that panel. So and a couple of facilities from Wake Forest here in north of me in North Carolina. So yeah, that was a great panel. That's still available on the ATA website.
And also on our website, BlueCirrus.com, I think we have that interview posted with Amon Johnson, a great interview about ATA and what's going on there.
That's true.
So Julia, thank you for joining the show. My question tonight for you is the customer success VP at BrightMD. How did you keep projects on track during this pandemic? Are you guys working remotely? What's your secret?
Mm-hmm. Great question, Joe. So I'll say prior to the pandemic, we'd already been working to shift towards an implementation model that required less time on site for our projects. And although that shift was helping us and our customers reduce overall costs, we wanted to make sure that we could still build and foster the partnerships with our customers that really are a cornerstone of our culture. So to do this, we rely heavily on a collaborative tool set, both internally and with customers, tools like Asana, Slack, Zoom. We've also initiated cross-team daily stand-up meetings that helps keeps us better connected and in sync on any upcoming customer deliverables, commitments, anything of that sort. Specifically with customers, though, there's even more of an emphasis on just weekly status reports, check-ins, upcoming deliverables, really making sure that we have our finger on the pulse of what's going on.
So, Julia, as the customer success VP at BrightMD, how did you keep projects on track during this pandemic? Are you working remotely?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question, Joe. I think I'll start with prior to the pandemic, we had already been working to shift towards an implementation model that required less time on site for our projects. And although that shift was helping us and our customers reduce overall costs, we really wanted to make sure that we could still build and foster the partnerships with our customers that are a fundamental cornerstone of our culture. So to do this, we rely heavily on a collaborative tool set, both internally and with customers, tools like Asana, Slack, Zoom. We've also initiated cross-team daily stand-up meetings. Those help keep us better connected and in sync on any upcoming customer deliverables and commitments. Specifically with customers, there's even more of an emphasis on those weekly status reports, check-ins, what's coming next. So really making sure that we are keeping our pulse on kind of what we need front and center to move things forward.
Communication is the key there.
Yes, absolutely. That said, we're in unprecedented times and showing grace, compassion, recognizing not everything may be delivered on time, right? That's important. And I believe our projects and the relationships we form with our customers are all the stronger for that. And we want to make sure we're doing everything within our means to support them.
Absolutely. And one thing that we're recording this through Zoom, because we use that as well to stay connected. I'm sure there's a variety of different tools to stay connected. But one thing that I think is great is the backgrounds that we all have now with Zoom and other types of tools. And you can't see it, listeners, but Julia has a great BrightMD background. I'm jealous of it. It's really great. So you talked about some of the challenges that you faced during the pandemic, and how do you adjust when you are working remotely? You are trying to do as much as you can to reduce the cost for the patient and for your clients that you're working with across the country, which are typically hospitals, I would imagine, and health systems.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. So for those organizations, when you're trying to do your best work and communicate, over-communicate in this time, how are you able to adjust from an IT perspective? Do you have to do anything differently? What challenges are you experiencing?
I think it's interesting in terms of the IT component and working remotely. So our office, so as you said, Joe, we're based in Portland, Oregon. Our office transitioned to 100% remote literally overnight. Back in March of this year. And I think having the right things like you mentioned, Michelle, Zoom, Slack, right, those collaborative tools, everything in the cloud, including our product, that just, I think, made it so much easier. And I would say we've definitely weathered it well. We're even now at a point where it's learning how to onboard entirely new employees remotely. So just brand new, right? Have never been in our office, don't even know where our office is. And it's, right, as you can imagine, shifting the kind of onboarding priorities. And I think the question for us is internally then, how do we make sure that they, right, understand the culture of our team, how we interact with our customers, what's most important, right? Just that more, I think, stylistic components to work and your company that can easily get lost when you're not face-to-face. But I also think on the flip side, it's incredibly exciting to think how all of this fundamentally shifts, changes our work styles and preferences and kind of what comes after the pandemic and a return to semi-normal, if we want to call it that.
Yeah, we need to get back to at least semi-normal, right?
Yes.
But that's fascinating. I think, you know, the idea of trying to set a culture for new employees when you are not able to work face-to-face with them or side-by-side with them, that is a unique challenge. And we've experienced that ourselves. I'm sure others have as well. And we're always trying to find new and different ways to be able to stay connected, stay sticky, making sure that we're communicating really well with everyone. So I can appreciate that challenge as well.
Yeah.
So what are some of the quick start technologies that BrightMD is offering for hospitals and health systems that are trying to put in digital health solutions to support their patients? We all know everybody is doing something digital today, right? We have to find some way to virtualize this. So what types of quick start technologies does BrightMD have for patients and for hospitals and their patients?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I think for us, it really comes down to three words: navigate, triage, treat.
Oh, that's great.
So yes, I'm sure there are many of us out there who can relate to not feeling well and not knowing where to go for care. So in order to reach us, right, those consumers and patients in the moment when care is needed, health systems really should have a simple way to navigate people to the right care at the right time for the right price. So that is, right, step one, navigation. And now, given the spike in virtual care options, chat, video, phone, remote monitoring, I could go on, it's essential to also incorporate that triage component into the process. Triage is helping ensure that the patient's on track to receive the right care in the right setting. And then lastly, in terms of treatment, I'd highlight everyone deserves to have a delightful and engaging experience with technology, including providers. So we have an incredible team of designers and engineers who've simply reimagined what it means for providers to deliver care remotely. And providers, as well as patients, are loving it. So with how our system packages and presents the information gathered, it takes providers 2 to 3 minutes to accurately diagnose and treat patients. So not only is this a safe and convenient care option, it's incredibly efficient for providers, scaling in a way that other virtual care options do not. And in short, that is navigate, triage, treat.
I love that. I love that terminology and the simpler, the better, right? Mm-hmm. The ease of use for the patient, for the provider.
Yeah.
And I think that, it's interesting to me that the software that I know BrightMD offers that isn't often talked about from a telehealth perspective. So this idea of an asynchronous or not in real time smart exam, you know, that allows the patient, I mean, how often have our listeners or even ourselves had a condition that comes up all the time and you know that it's what it is and your doctor knows what it is before you call them or as soon as you talk to them. So being able to just sort of easily answer quick questions and having that go to the office and they say, oh yes, I remember this. Michelle has this all the time. And, you know, we can easily write this prescription. That makes it so much more convenient because we all recognize I'll call it the irritation, right? You know what you need. It's a prescription refill. And then suddenly you have to sort of come back in or a new prescription. You have to come back in to do something that we all know before I go there, especially now, trying to protect in a pandemic, during a pandemic. So wanted to make sure our listeners knew about that ease of use for that application that BrightMD has.
Yes, thank you, Michelle. I think 100%. That is, maybe I would highlight, right, with telehealth, it is more than just video. And you're absolutely right that it's very common for new users, new consumers, patients to not even realize that this type of asynchronous care is an option for them and is at times even more convenient and effective than a video visit could be. So,
Absolutely. So now that you, you know, told us about BrightMD, and now that you're moving forward, as we said, into the sort of new normal, what are some of the things that you're thinking about in terms of COVID and some of the CDC guidelines, and how is BrightMD, what is BrightMD, you know, saying about that or thinking about that?
Yep. I would highlight a few things. So we have one of the conditions that we treat, or we refer to them as modules that we offer, is a blended COVID, cold cough, flu, allergy assessment that patients can undergo. And that's something that we've had in place, I think, since the end of January when the CDC first started to release their guidelines. And we update it as soon as that new guidance comes out. That's within our kind of full product. But then we also, and it, I think this is worth noting, as we move into fall and the possibility of that twindemic, we are still offering a free COVID-19 online screening tool to all health systems in the US. So the screening content, again, regularly updated based on CDC guidelines. And the screener itself is really easy to set up, so patients can access it directly from their health system's homepage and get the help and guidance they need.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's a great thing. You know, being able to do that across the country, what a great service. That's great, Julia. Joe?
No, I saw something on the news this morning where schools will be able to take temperature of students in groups, in groups at a time. So a lot of cool things coming out to help healthcare and protect kids in school and now patients in the hospital and fighting this pandemic and this COVID-19.
It is expected now every day when you go in that's part of your process is to have your temperature taken.
That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So thank you, Julia. Folks interested in BrightMD and looking for extensive information and resources can find it on their website at bright.md, which includes comprehensive guides to help build your digital strategies, safety, deliver care in under 2 minutes, and how to create system-wide efficiencies in your health network. Julia and Michelle, I appreciate your time to join our show tonight. I look forward to hearing more and how this year turns out for you. I would love to have you back in a few months, Julia. That would be great. Please stay healthy and safe.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Julia. Don't forget, everybody, take your flu shot.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks, Michelle. This was fun and happy to come back. Have a good night.
Thank you. This is WATD Radio 95.9 FM. We will be right back after this quick break from our sponsors.
Hey, Joe, please tell me about your new company, Blue Cirrus Consulting. This is a new way I can actually stay home and receive quality healthcare by using today's technology?
Yeah, thanks. It's called telehealth. It's sweeping the nation. It's great. It saves lives, it saves time, and it saves money.
Great, but why isn't my hospital offering it to me?
Well, hospitals are being flooded with new software vendors and technology, making it difficult for hospitals to make clear decisions and choose which telehealth program is right for them. In fact, Blue Cirrus Consulting can bring telehealth to local hospitals here in New England. We have a track record of providing skilled advisors, clinicians, and project leaders to support your hospital and help them accomplish a quality telehealth program.
Hey, Joe, how do I find out more information?
Thanks, Paul. You can go online at blue-cirrus.com. That's blue as in the color, dash Cirrus, C-I-R-R-U-S, as in the cloud, .com, and find all of our company information online. Blue Cirrus saves lives, saves time, and saves money.
And final guest on the radio with us tonight is another local doctor from Signature Healthcare in Brockton, Dr. Henry Garzioso, who is Residency Program Director of the BIDMC, Transitional Year Residency, and Director of Medical Education at the hospital. He specializes in emergency medicine, graduated medical school at the University of Connecticut School of Medicine, and did his residency at the Medical College of Pennsylvania. I met Doc Henry in Marshfield, who is a neighbor to my very good friends, Mark and Rachel Healy, and I'm super excited to have him on the phone with us tonight. Hello, Dr. Henry. Thanks for joining the show with us tonight.
Thank you, Joe and Michelle. It's a pleasure to be on with you tonight.
So, Doc Henry, we've been thanking doctors and nurses, first responders on this show every week, and appreciate your dedication to keeping us safe during this difficult time. Thank you so much.
It's been a difficult year with the pandemic, and everyone at Signature Healthcare is committed to keeping our community safe and healthy. I would also note that there are many other frontline workers, greeters, techs, nursing assistants, and support staff who have been mightily affected as well, not to mention countless other workers in the community staying on the job to make our lives as normal as possible. So we thank them as well.
That's such a good point. There's all these back office folks that people don't see, whether those are people that are registering patients or pharmacists or lab techs that are all interacting with, or transportation that are all interacting with patients and right there on the front lines with you. So that's generous of you, Dr. Jada, to speak of them as well. It's something that those folks are behind the scenes.
We have a few questions for you, Doc. As an ER physician, you're typically the first stop in the line of treatment. And I read on your website that you receive over 62,000 ER visits per year. So tell us, what's it like working at Signature Healthcare, and how are you protecting yourself?
Well, the first thing I would say is it does not feel normal working through the pandemic. The interesting thing, though, for our clinical staff is that we're quite used to dangerous pathogens in the community. And initially, in the first several weeks, it really didn't feel that strange because we've had previous experience with Ebola, with H1N1. It's not unusual for us to be in full protective equipment related to dangerous pathogens, meningitis. I think that everyone just thought it was going to pass sooner. The real challenging aspect has been the duration of the pandemic and the duration of the measures necessary. The hospital looked anything but normal in the peak months during the surge. There were closures of offices. All surgical cases had been canceled. The ICU was completely full with patients. And we converted our post-anesthesia care unit, the PACU, was completely converted into a negative pressure COVID ICU. And at peak, we had 16 patients in an open negative pressure unit just lined up on ventilators and BiPAP. It was quite stressful. Not to mention the enhanced roles for some of our staff. We had floor nurses who were in full PPE in a complete negative pressure unit, and having to stay like that all day. I think it was very stressful for them. As far as protecting ourselves, we very early on went to routine screening. The surgical cancellations to an extent protected patients and staff. The hospital fortunately was very proactive in rapid testing and in procuring PPE, which was not easy. A quick story about that. We were fearing we were going to be short. We grouped with 40 other hospitals and put together a $50 million order, including the Mayo Clinic was one of the hospitals, to try to get masks. And we got nothing because we were overbid by the state of California, who had put in a $500 million order and said that the deal was off if they didn't receive all their masks first. So our $50 million order, including the Mayo Clinic, did not happen.
Wow.
So it was quite something, I have to say. And I mean, at this point, lots of things have fortunately resumed. In the residency, we canceled all non-essential face-to-face meetings. Things have calmed down. The good news is that there's a good amount of research that really suggests that with adequate PPE, healthcare workers and hospital staff are actually quite safe.
Thank goodness. So they can stop, preventing themselves from being infected. But I think you made a good point in there about the negative pressure rooms. I think this is a nuance that people may not understand.
Welcome back to our show. We have Blue Sarah Consulting Managing Partner, Michelle Hager,
you know,
on the
might
phone
say,
with
well,
us.
There's plenty of hospital beds in a hospital for patients to be able to be treated for COVID. But the reality is it needs to be in the special rooms, which have particular, these negative pressure rooms that are created that have airflow that specifically go through them. And as you noted, you've had experience with that with Ebola. So you had, already you've already got those infectious protocols in place. But I think sometimes it's hard to understand that there are only certain rooms that these patients can go into. And in some hospitals, they've dedicated the entire surgical wing for the purposes of taking care of those patients, because they're not performing surgeries, and now they can use them for COVID patients. Mm. But that is the engine in terms of keeping the hospital's doors open. The story of the PPE is amazing. We hear about it on the news. So that's real life. What are you doing now with PPE? Are you reusing it? Do you have plenty?
Yeah, at this point we do. I think we were certainly more fortunate than some urban areas in that we never reached critical low volumes of PPE supplies. We were reusing some masks for short periods of time, but there was never a time where if somebody needed some component of PPE, they couldn't get it. The hospital was protective of it because early on, quite frankly, either patients or other people were hoarding it for their own department. Right. But it fortunately was available. And in the lull, we'll see if there's another surge that stresses the system similarly. But in the lull, we've been able to get more than enough that we should be covered, even if there is another significant surge. So that's fortunate.
That's good to hear. So serving the population that's underserved is always a challenge. How do you keep people safe from COVID-19? What measures are you taking?
We mainly, the first step we take is we follow the basics, which really goes quite a long way toward preventing illness. We do good screening, including questions and temperature screening, which is a separate discussion, but it's a component of screening. Routine masking of all staff, all visitors, all patients, good hand washing procedures, enhanced sanitization of the hospital, but mm-hmm. especially patient care areas, and more enhanced airflow. You know, we still, the negative pressure issue comes back. That's one of the ways we protect ourselves and protect the other patients. Similar to what Michelle mentioned, our entire fifth floor was completely converted to negative pressure. So the nurses there who had been used to taking care of regular med-surg patients were suddenly running a COVID unit. And I'm sure that was very stressful to them. And then as far as the way things are now, we continue to screen and test before any procedures. Starting at the beginning of the pandemic, or close to the beginning, initially there was some issue with test availability, but the hospital was very good at procuring rapid testing equipment and rapid testing reagents so that we were able to do that. So at this point, and really for the last at least several months, every single patient who's admitted to the hospital is tested, even if they have no symptoms whatsoever. So everyone is screened. The other thing that the hospital has done, and fortunately we have some forward-thinking medical staff, but we were able to really gain access to all of the latest treatments, even if they were experimental or were only available under an emergency use authorization. So very early on, we were using convalescent plasma, remdesivir, steroids, well before any of the larger data sets came out that really beneficial. We had a strong suspicion that they were, and our affiliation with PI was quite useful also because they had remdesivir and they were gracious enough to allow us to use it.
Oh, that's great that you were able to utilize that connection with BDI and take even better care of your patients utilizing all the different types of experimental and cutting edge medicine. It's a blessing for both the patient and for the clinicians. I think sometimes people may assume that, well, they're doctors, they're nurses, they already know how to deal with all of this. But in some cases, that's a great learning experience for not just yourselves as clinicians on the floors or in the ER for, like yourself, but your residents that you're also teaching along the way. What did you do with your residents? What impact did the residents have to your ability to care for patients?
Well, the residents just basically found themselves in a, hopefully, once-in-a-lifetime experience. They are essential staff, so their duties continued as if they were attending staff. So they quickly had to learn about the newest treatments and stay up to date. We had twice a week COVID update rounds where we talked about the latest literature so everyone was up to date. But yeah, they were in full PPE, and in the peak surge months, every single patient that they cared for was COVID positive. So they they cared for the full range of illness, from mildly ill to needing the ICU. We had residents rotating through the ICU at the time, so they were taking care of the very sickest patients. Interestingly, it was our residents that were in the ambulatory rotation that had the most impact, because all of the routine visits were canceled. But that's where our residents doing ambulatory medicine got their first big exposure, probably to telehealth, because we very quickly had to move to that platform.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, and those residents, boy, talk about being put on the front line and fighting the fight. Thank you to them and their services as well. And as you know, Dr. Henry, Blue Cirrus Consulting is helping hospitals across the country in helping them implement a strong business plan and strategies for using telehealth. So my question is, how much have you been relying on telehealth to provide care in the ER? Do you direct them toward a telehealth selection?
Signature Healthcare has relied mightily on telehealth, although the emergency department really used it on a much more limited basis. The system that Signature put in place was that patients who were concerned about symptoms that might be related to COVID would typically contact their primary care physician. The primary care physicians were directing a lot of patients using telehealth. Early on, it was a fear that the emergency departments would get completely overrun. So we were trying to triage people to appropriate levels of care. We're lucky that in our community that did not happen, although that was not the experience in some urban areas. But in the emergency department, telehealth did still play a role, particularly taking care of patients who did not necessarily need a physical interaction. So for instance, we do a very high psychiatric volume. We have 24/7 psych clinicians. We have an inpatient psychiatry service. So once someone came in and was medically cleared, their psychiatry visit would be done by telehealth, for instance. In the outpatient setting though, in terms of being able to buffer the ER volume, using telehealth to appropriately triage people, that helped us mightily. The hospital set up parking lot-based outdoor testing sites, so people that were relatively well and essentially just needed a test could go there. And if they were in between, they actually opened up a previously closed site that was called the Sick or Not Sick Sons Clinic. And if they didn't really know, they would go get checked out there. And then if they were still didn't look so good, then they would go on to the emergency department. So we really used it on a number of levels.
Well, that's a good workflow.
As far as telehealth selection, I was not part of that decision-making process. But I believe the outpatient departments at Signature are using Bluestream.
So with influx of mental health patients into the emergency room and some of the, you know, with the pandemic, the stressors related to that, how are you and others in your emergency room, or even what you've heard from other organizations, how are you coping with that, dealing with that? Because psychiatric services are very rare, or they're in demand and they're not as prevalent. So what are you doing to address that need, or what strategies are you employing?
Well, fortunately, the function of the inpatient psych unit is close to back to normal now. One of the problems during the pandemic for many of the inpatient facilities, and this includes both psychiatric care unrelated to substance use disorder, but also related to substance use disorder, in the peak of the pandemic, some of them were just closed. They did not feel that they could take patients at all. And then some that were opened decreased their bed volume, you know, stressing an already extremely stressed portion of the system. Michelle, as you point out, almost every state is relatively underserved with inpatient psych beds. There is any magic solution to that. The solution that tends to happen is that the emergency department has to hang on to them and try to provide the care in that setting until an inpatient bed is available. So during the surge, what we just noticed is that our volume of psychiatric patients was up because it was hard to get them into any longer term care.
Yeah, that's pretty tough with those patients that are coming in. I think it's an important point for listeners to know about, that patients that have mental health issues often, because of that shortage, end up, as you said, boarding in the emergency room and managed in the emergency room for multiple days, maybe even weeks in some hospitals, and discharged from the emergency room because they cannot find an inpatient mental health bed. So you're right to call it a national tragedy, because so many patients are not actually able to get the right type of help and get those inpatient beds. We need to focus on that as a society, for sure. And I know Joe has some other questions for you as well.
Yeah, please, Doc Henry, we have a few minutes more. I'd like to ask you just a few more questions. Pandemic continues. Have you seen more domestic violence in the ER room? What has changed and how are you able to adapt to it?
Institutionally, we actually have not noted an increase in interpersonal violence, either as the cause for an ER visit or directed toward our staff. I don't know if, I know people have been feeling anxious about it, but they seem to be very understanding once they got there. Now, the issue is that people were afraid at times to come to the emergency department because of the pandemic. So the possibility that there were victims of interpersonal or domestic violence who never came in certainly exists. And that continues to be a concern as the, you know, lockdowns drag on. And certainly spending increased time in enclosed spaces, you know, may increase the likelihood that abusers would act out. But we actually had decreased overall volumes, but increased volume of very sick people. So from a staffing standpoint, the ER was really not crowded during the peak months. In fact, our volume is just over the last couple of months started to come back to about 90%. Typically, we saw more patients, if you were to compare month to month to the last several years, we actually saw fewer through the surge months. But the patients that were there were more critically ill in general. That was our experience, but in some urban areas, they were completely overrun, particularly New York and New Jersey.
That's interesting. I think knowing that patients were staying away from the emergency room for those non-acute type of issues that normally come up, certainly in my healthcare experience, the full moon, people that would come in, or COVID scenario, just really made them think and double check themselves and think, well, maybe I don't need to go, maybe I'm okay, and I can stay away from that. It's interesting the volumes went down.
So the Signature Healthcare Brockton Hospital Transitional Year Residency Program has been in existence since 1974 and is a not-for-profit community teaching hospital clinically affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and serves a very diverse population, and the emergency department is one of the busiest in the region. What type of training can be expected in this residency program? Are you teaching them how to use telehealth, or do you see a need to do so?
Well, our residency offers broad-based training across a lot of different fields, mainly for residents going into highly specialized fields who need another year of experience with hospital-based medical specialties before they complete their specialty training. So most of our residents go through internal medicine, which is about half the year. They train in surgery, emergency medicine, critical care, and ambulatory medicine. The residency, as it's developed over time, really tries to focus on patient safety and the cognitive process in medicine and cognitive bias and error, and to do our best to eliminate those biases. We also focus on resident wellness and hopefully the joy of learning. So I think our residents really like our program. We've become quite popular. We have about 700 applicants for 9 spots.
Wow.
So it's actually technically harder to get into our residency than it is to get into Harvard Medical
School. Into actual medical school.
I'll say, wow.
As far as telehealth, as I mentioned earlier, if it weren't for the pandemic, our residents probably would have had much less exposure to telehealth. But I'm hoping, and I think a lot of people are hoping, that we can see some good come from having to go through something like this. We learn about a lot about our delivery system. We learn a lot about supply system. And in our case, the residents learned a lot about telehealth, particularly in the ambulatory block. And a lot of them are going into specialties. About half of our folks are going into either ophthalmology or dermatology. And those are specialties that lend themselves, particularly dermatology, lend themselves to patient interaction with a telehealth platform. During the pandemic, one of our residents really got a chance to participate in building the telehealth system because he was at the ambulatory site when the pandemic hit. So he got a chance to see what it's like to react in real time and have to problem solve with a system that had used telehealth probably only minimally theretofore. There were some very good experiences. At this point, when all the residents rotate through the ambulatory rotation, though, they have some exposure to it now because it's been set up.
That's great. Well,
we'd like to talk to him. That's interesting.
Absolutely. Especially, like you said, with dermatology, it lends itself directly to utilizing telehealth. And as long as you're able to get past, you know, some of the processes that you need to do. We had Carolyn from ODU on the show, and we'll have her on the show a little bit later in the year, and she'll talk about some of the strategies to learning how to better talk to patients to get some of that cognitive bias out of your practice, and then also, you know, to try to get as much information from the client. Do a physical exam essentially over telehealth. How do you able to do that? So that's a great educational program and a great way for those residents to learn how to better practice medicine via telehealth and other modalities.
Yeah, that's a good point, Michelle, and she'll be on the show in November. Carolyn Rutledge from ODU. Well, Dr. Henry Grazioso, thank you so much for your time tonight. Our show's goal is to bring our listeners educated and established doctors, nurses, and healthcare workers in to speak with us. We want to provide our listeners the latest information in healthcare, not only locally, but on a national level. We had a great show tonight. Dr. Grazioso and Michelle, I appreciate your time to join us. Dr. Henry, I look forward to hearing more on how your year turns out for you, and I'd love to have you back in maybe a couple months and follow up. So please stay healthy and stay safe.
Thanks, Joe. This was fun. You're going to need to give me an hour, though. Have a good night.
Next time.
This is Friends with Benefits on WATD Radio 95.9 FM. Thank you for listening.